Earthquakes and radioactive water. The recent 7.6 earthquake off the northeast coast of Japan did not set off a tsunami like the one that demolished three Fukushima nuclear reactors 14 years ago. But it has stirred up the Pacific Ocean sediment in that area, including all the way down to Fukushima, and that has resuspended radionuclides from the triple meltdown back into the ocean. Japan and Tokyo Electric Power Company, TEPCO, insist that there's nothing to worry our pretty little heads about, that the radiation levels barely exist and present no danger to life and health. But then a marine biologist who specializes in radiation issues in water and is very familiar with these issues tells you,
fish species absorb radioactivity and end up with radioactivity concentrations much higher than the water they're swimming in because they absorb it from the food that they're eating. So even the tiniest, minutest marine organisms absorb radioactivity in small doses, but the fish come along and eat lots and lots of that stuff, and therefore they do what we call biomagnify. So their levels of radioactivity are higher than the little tiny microorganism that they're eating. Then something like a shark or a seal or a walrus comes along, or a whale or a dolphin, and eats that stuff, and it eats lots and lots of fish, and it biomagnifies the radioactivity level. So the same issue applies to human beings who eat seafoods, because we're at the top of the food chain, so we're eating the guys who've been accumulating all these various concentrations of these various nuclides. We get a bigger dose.
And marine biologist Tim Deer Jones spells out the kind of information on possible radiation contamination that you will never get from the Japanese government, TEPCO, any of the other nukesters, or even, for the most part, mainstream media. You realize how pervasive and unavoidable the problem is, and you recognize that you and I and everyone else are sitting smack in the middle of that awful, dangerous, deadly seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat, it's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. We're a show for people who know nothing about nuclear who want to know something, and people who know something about nuclear who would like to know just a little bit more. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, UK-based marine biologist Tim Deer Jones explains what happens in the aftermath of an earthquake, such as the recent Japanese 7.6 earthquake, when it shakes up the seabed where radionuclides from Fukushima have settled. It is not a pretty picture, and holds the threat of long-standing impact on not just the marine environment, but on all of us. We'll also have media tips on how to attract reporters to the nuclear story. This is for activists, not for nukesters. They've got money. They don't need these tips. We do. And the tips come from an Emmy Award-winning journalist, Helen Young. She is the director of the award-winning documentary, The Nuns, the Priests, and the Bombs, which covers the work of Sister Megan Rice and the Plowshares Movement. Are they criminals or prophets sending a wake-up call to the world? Listen and learn. We will also have nuclear news from around the world and more honest nuclear information than Santa's going to be putting in your stocking or under your tree. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, December 16, 2025, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. We're going to cut to the chase with the first of two featured interviews. Tim Deere Jones is a marine biologist, a marine radioactivity researcher and consultant, and regular contributor to Nuclear Hot Seat. He specializes in analysis of the radiation threats to our planet's waters from a wide range of nuclear sources. Here, he looks at the impact that Japan's December 8, 2025 earthquake, which was a 7.6 and took place off the northeast coast of that country, may have had on the tritium-contaminated radioactive water being released from Fukushima. I spoke with Tim Deere Jones on December 14, 2025. Tim Deere Jones, always great to have you here as a guest on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Oh, Libby, it's always a pleasure to talk to you as a guest.
Let's start with some basic information so people can understand what we're talking about here. How do radioactive substances, also referred to as radionuclides, behave when they are released into a marine environment, in this case, the Pacific Ocean?
Okay, well, first, some of those radionuclides are present in dissolved form when they're released, and others are present already in particulate form, in particle form when they're released, so solids and liquids radioactivity. Now, a certain amount of the liquid radioactivity when it gets into the marine environment will actually prefer to transfer itself out of the water phase and attach to sedimentary floating particles in the sea. So then they become attached to the particles. Those particles in due course will group together into what we call flocks, and the flocks are heavier than water and they will sink to the seabed. So the seabed becomes quite an important repository, if you like, of the radionuclides that have been discharged from reactor accidents and reactor operational discharges.
Tokyo Electric Power Company has been releasing the radioactive water from Fukushima since August 2023. They've been just letting it out into the Pacific Ocean. It is already approximately 125,000 meters of what they call ALPS treated water, ALPS being the system by which they remove radionuclides, but not all of the radionuclides. They started in August 2023, and as of last week, TEPCO has started on the 17th batch of release. They say the water is safe because of this ALPS system. But as I said, it does not remove tritium, and I believe there are other radionuclides as well that are not removed. And the number of cubic meters that they've already released is the equivalent of more than 50 Olympic-sized swimming pools. In your estimation, how safe is this water release, and what is it doing?
Assuming that it's going to dilute and the whole issue of discharging radioactive waste into the sea is based on the original 1940s and 1950s theory that they conjured up, that it would dilute and disappear and become sort of infinitely disappeared and therefore pose no threat to the wildlife or to human beings. But actually, my work, amongst others, my desk review of other scientists' work has demonstrated that it actually reconcentrates in a number of different forms in the marine environment. So fish species absorb radioactivity and end up with radioactivity concentrations much higher than the water they're swimming in because they absorb it from the food that they're eating. So even the tiniest, minutest marine organisms absorb radioactivity in small doses, but the fish come along and eat lots and lots of that stuff, and therefore they do what we call biomagnify. So their levels of radioactivity are higher than the little tiny microorganisms that they're eating. Then something like a shark or a seal or a walrus comes along, or a whale or a dolphin, and eats that stuff, and it eats lots and lots of fish, and it biomagnifies the radioactivity level. So the same issue applies to human beings who eat seafoods. because we're at the top of the food chain, so we're eating the guys who've been accumulating all these various concentrations of these various nuclides, we get a bigger dose. So if you eat fish once a week or maybe once a month, maybe you're not getting too bad a dose. But if you're eating fish and seaweed and eating marine supplements and fish oils and stuff like that, then you're going to get a pretty heavy dose. And if you eat regularly fish, like a lot of the people along the Japanese coast and a lot of the people in the Pacific are really big fish consumers and seafood consumers, then they're going to get big doses. So that's one way how radioactivity discharge to sea doesn't dilute and disperse to infinity. It actually reconcentrates. And secondly, as I just discussed earlier on, the seabed sediments reconcentrate radioactivity because radioactivity sticks to little floating particles. All the little floating particles adhere together and become heavier than water and sink to the seabed. So the seabed is another reconcentrator.
When you talk about the way decisions were made about radiation and radionuclides in the 50s and the early 60s, there was a phrase that came out during that time, which is dilution is the solution to pollution, which was a very clever piece of wordplay to take our minds off the fact that that is not true, that even in the smallest amounts, it pollutes and compromises the health of the marine environment. Let's move this along to December 8th of this year, 2025. That's when a 7.6 earthquake struck the Pacific Ocean off the coast of Aomori Prefecture in Sanriko, Japan. And that was 7.6. There have been aftershocks measuring as high as 6.6. What is significant about this happening in the Aomori region?
Well, first of all, it's a well-established fact that earthquakes cause the movement and resuspension of seabed sediments. Now, as we've already just discussed, seabed sediments reconcentrate the radioactivity that's discharged into them. So the Aomori earthquake occurred many miles, 40 kilometers north of the Japanese coast up there, and that was quite a long way away from the Fukushima site. So I expect TEPCO and the Japanese government are going to be saying, oh, nothing much to worry about that. It was so far away, even though it was so large. But there's two things to remember here. And one is that studies have shown that such earthquakes can affect seabed sediments at least 200 miles away. Now, that was a scientific study that found that out. So that takes you 200 kilometers closer to the Fukushima site. And then secondly, the reports from Japan after that earthquake indicated that there was at best moderate seismic activity felt in the Fukushima area. So that too will have disturbed the seabed sediments down as far south as Fukushima. Now, we know from studies that were done by independent analysts and also by TEPCO and the Japanese government that up to 200 kilometers north of the Fukushima site, Fukushima radioactivity was found on the seabed and in marine sediments and marine samples up there. So, all in all, really what's happened is that at that 200 kilometer north of Fukushima site, there will have been disturbance, quite severe disturbance, because this is what the scientific studies say. Within 200 km of the epicenter, you will get severe disturbance of the sediments. So that there, you will have had a lot of radioactive sediment released. And once it's released, it can then enter the water column and it can be transported and it can rise up to the surface. At the same time, off the Fukushima site, where you had moderate seismicity, you will also have had some seabed sediment disturbance, and that stuff too can rise up to the surface. Why does it rise up to the surface? Because off the Japanese coast, or the Pacific coast, you have what's called an upwelling, which is where seabed water is driven to the surface by various marine processes. So that will bring that radioactive seabed sourced sediment and organic material as well. It will bring it up to the surface and make it available to the animals that are living nearer the sea surface than the deep sea bed, and also to coastal populations and any coastal aquaculture that's going on. And then, as you know, because we've spoken about this before, there are multiple ways by which radioactivity can come back from the sea to the land. And those processes are currently operating off the Japanese coast, and they will be bringing any additional radioactivity from the earthquake source back to the land. And this is in addition to what's being discharged from the Fukushima site right now, the material that was discharged historically during the accident and will still be lying around in the seabed from the previous Fukushima discharges. So it's my conclusion that there may well be evidence to be found of additional radioactivity in the marine water column off the Japanese coast.
And I'd like to make the point that during this 7.6 earthquake, Fukushima experienced ground tremors that were described as moderate, but they were perhaps so far beyond moderate that activity at the Daiichi plant was closed down for the duration of the event and for a bit of time afterwards.
Yeah, that's correct. And people living in the area reported feeling tremors in their homes and there being some disturbance to furniture and glasses on the table, etc., etc.
So let's say that it's fair to assume that this 7.6 earthquake in early December stirred up the radionuclides from the bed of the Pacific Ocean, especially around Fukushima. What then happens to them? Do they stay there? Do they just sink down? Do they travel? What happens?
Okay, well, when we marine scientists talk about marine sediments, we're talking about everything from pebbles and rocks up to the very finest microparticles of silt and clay. And those particles, the finer particles, are potentially able to float. Now, I talked to you earlier about how fine particles will aggregate together and make a larger particle called a flock, which sinks to the seabed. But at the same time, if those flocks are kicked about and shaken and disturbed, they can break apart, and the fine particles then are released as individual particles, and then they will be able to be transported for many miles in a horizontal and also in a vertical direction. So in a vertical direction, they can rise up to the surface. This is assisted along the Pacific coast of Japan by something called an upwelling current, which is where seabed currents are pushed, if you like, for simple analogy, they're pushed against the coast and then they rise up to the surface or towards the surface, and the material in them, organic particles and sedimentary particles, will become incorporated into that rising water, come up to the surface, and then they're available for consumption and interaction with surface marine species like finfish, shellfish on the coast, aquacultural products, seaweed and marine algae, which are used as food, and also people who are living in the coastal strip by sea to land transfer, and people who are working in the marine environment as stakeholders, fishers, aquaculturalists, and even mariners.
How far can the radionuclides disturbed in this way that come up to the surface, how far can they travel from Fukushima, or do they just kind of hang around the neighborhood?
As an additional complication, what you have off that coast of Japan is a very significant and important and powerful marine current called the Oyoshio, which is bringing cold, nutrient, organic-rich water down from the polar regions and running it down that east coast of Japan towards the more central and southern Pacific areas. So that's a current which travels pretty quickly. It's bringing material down into Japanese waters all the way from the polar regions. So carrying stuff from one end of Japan to another is no problem for a current that can do that because of its speed. And it's very broad, it's very deep, and it's traveling pretty fast as marine currents go. So yeah, the transport, and certainly I've always critiqued the Japanese government and TEPCO because they basically made a major attempt to limit their analysis and monitoring of the radioactivity discharge from the site to the Fukushima area, and they were very reluctant to spread their work further south and find out just how far this stuff was spreading and how important the concentrations were. And they haven't improved that much since the original days.
I have to check in on a slightly different story. There were reports earlier this year of radioactively contaminating fish, seafood, other products coming from Indonesia. And it was discovered that there were container vessels or vats that were being transported that had become radioactive. Is it something that is connected with this, or might this be a separate issue completely?
It may be either, Levy, to be honest with you. I did do some work on that, and what I discovered was that it's prawns, wasn't it, that we're talking about, prawns or shrimp,
Yes.
the seafoods. And actually, some of the Indonesian aquaculture companies have been buying food supplies, which are based on seafood leftovers, or sort of, the kind of the rubbish left over after processing seafoods. They've been buying this stuff from Japan. A, there is a possibility that the food that the company that was producing those particular seafoods may have been feeding those prawns on material that was brought in Japan. That remains an open question, and it hasn't been proved because nobody on the ground there seems to have bothered to make a major attempt to check it out. Secondly, there are many examples of radioactive waste metals finding their way into the scrap metal market, and the scrap metal market produces those shipping containers in large numbers. You might remember that a few years back there was a bit of a scandal because a big import load of cutlery produced in China had been imported into Canada, knives, forks, and spoons, and that was found to be radioactive because it had been made from steel which had been contaminated with radioactive material that had entered into the scrap metal market. Something similar happened, I think, in Taiwan, where they were building houses with rolled steel girders from China, and they were also found to be, the houses had to be demolished, the people had to be removed from the houses because the rolled steel girders were all radioactive because they too had been contaminated. So the whole issue of radioactive waste is just a real mess. You can see how chaotic it is. You get radioactive waste quite potentially entering marine seafoods, entering food which is being fed to farmed seafoods, and entering the scrap metal market. So people are living in houses that are contaminated by it, eating off knives and forks and spoons that are contaminated by it, and carrying stuff around in containers that are contaminated by it. It just shows what a Wild West scenario radioactive waste is.
It's kind of like the opposite of the goose that laid the golden egg, because when you touch it, nothing turns to gold, but it turns to a word that I can't quite say it because I've got broadcast outlets here.
Yes, you're right.
And also regarding scrap metal, just to tie this in, last week the numbnuts of the week was about Chernobyl releasing 22,000 tons of what they're calling formerly radioactive steel. And the only thing I can think of that's formerly radioactive is lead. So that's a whole other story. But let's bring this back to Fukushima and the radionuclides that are being stirred up in the seabed. What is Japan, the government, and what is TEPCO, the company, even though it is under the control of Japan now, what are they doing to monitor and track the radiation, the radionuclides that are being released into the ocean, and most specifically, since the earthquake on December 8th?
Okay, well, they have a routine monitoring program in place to look at the impacts of the regular water discharges that they're doing. And as you referred to earlier, that stuff actually contains detectable amounts of pretty much all of the radionuclides that you would expect. It's got plutonium, americium, strontium, cesium, cobalt-60, tritium, you name it. Okay, well, what we know is that as the years have gone by, they've restricted and narrowed the area that they do any monitoring on. So that, as I mentioned earlier, I would regard that as being ineffective, and whether or not it's deliberately intended, it will give them a best case scenario result because they're not looking further afield. And I suppose their argument is based on the fact that, oh, well, we're looking in the area where the discharge is most concentrated. But what they're doing is not really a very good job of monitoring because they're monitoring the seawater. So we understand and agree that the seawater is constantly being diluted and it's spreading out, and the radioactivity in the plume of the discharge is reducing as it gets further and further away from the site. But what they're not taking account of is the fact that downstream there are fish species and sedimentary environments and marine plant environments that can reconcentrate that material, and there are sea to land transfer mechanisms which can also reconcentrate that material. I've spoken with you before about this. The sea to land transfer mechanisms of sea spray and marine aerosols created in the surf zone actually reconcentrates radioactivity to several hundred times higher levels than is found in the ambient water body, i.e. the water body that the radioactivity comes from. Complicated science here. We don't need to go into this at the moment, but I think we probably talked about this in previous blogs.
What really stuck with me was the fact that the aerosols, as you're talking about, the mist can travel great distances inland. So you don't have to be on the coast or in the water to be exposed to this. It's what we call here in California the morning marine layer. And that can go many miles inland and deposit radioactivity if it is present there.
That's absolutely true. And I'd cite a mixed example from the UK where they did studies and they found that when the sea to land transfer is occurring, some of the material that transfers is organic. So it's very small bacteria and viruses. And that has some of the highest concentrations of radioactivity of all of the materials that are processing from the sea to the land. Now, in Texas and Florida, a study was done way back in the 80s by a guy called Blanchard, who actually discovered that people were getting an infection called Batty's infection, which was giving them big lung problems. And this was a marine virus which was being blown up to 100 miles inland. Now, if you relate that little story to the story that I just mentioned about what was found in the UK, that bacteria and viruses concentrate radioactivity up to several times higher than found in the marine water, then you can imagine that some of those bacteria that can blow up to 100 miles inland may be carrying relatively high levels of radioactivity in them. And as we can see from the Batty's infection story in Texas and Florida, people are inhaling that stuff and getting it into their lungs. So that's a significant story which nobody really wants to investigate from a radioactivity point of view. Now, going back to TEPCO and Co., they don't want to look at this stuff right from the very beginning. In the instance, I was writing to TEPCO and writing to the IAEA on behalf of various groups, including the Pacific Island Forum and some of your colleagues and fellow campaigners on the California coast, warning and citing this work and this evidence that we have from the UK and other sources, and saying that really sea to land transfer ought to be something that ought to be thought about and it should be examined, and TEPCO and the Japanese authorities should be putting up monitors on the coastline to measure the onshore winds and see what's happened. Now, since then, just to add to this story, we have now discovered, and I think it was a paper 2 or 3 years old now, that radioactivity will evaporate off the surface of a sea surface plume. And this was done in France, and it was measuring the evaporation rate of tritium, off a sea surface plume. Now, as you know, as everybody who's interested in this story knows, the one thing that the Japanese government and co admit that they can't get out of the Alps treated water discharge from Fukushima is tritium. But there we have a 2 or 3 year old study now which says that tritium evaporates off the surface of a marine discharge plume, and therefore, if it's evaporating off the surface, it's forming a mist, condensate, minute aerosol droplets, and it'll blow inshore if there's an onshore wind. So somebody ought to be monitoring that. Now, I haven't said to you that I would advise that the Japanese government, the Japanese people, and the afflicted, potentially affected coastal critical groups, who are those people who are, by their where they live and what they do and their eating habits and their lifestyle habits, are likely to be exposed to marine radioactivity. All those people should agitate and insist that a whole set of additional monitoring and analytical work is done off the Japanese coast in the areas which are downstream of the earthquake and possibly downstream of the resuspended marine sediments, which may well now be drifting around, just to find out if it's happening, if it is happening, how serious it is. But I would suspect from previous experience that that won't happen, because neither TEPCO, nor the Japanese government, nor the world nuclear industry, nor the International Atomic Energy Agency really want to dig into these things, because it's all jolly bad news for them, and it can only earn them unnecessary publicity, which they will find to be negative. So they won't do it.
If we were to come up with any data on this, where might it come from? How could this be citizen sourced?
Well, this is the problem, isn't it? Because, I mean, I do a lot of work with citizens groups in the UK, and I've done some with citizens groups elsewhere. You've got to raise the money to pay for the analysis. You can collect the samples. That's we can all, you know, we can organize. We have down here in the UK, we organize various groups, raised enough money to fund people to travel along the coastline, collect samples of sediment and collect samples of water, etc., etc., and package them up and send them away to be analysed. All analysis is very expensive. Now, what we have usually done is commission from a specialised laboratory, an independent laboratory, not a government laboratory or a nuclear industry laboratory, but an independent laboratory, and preferably one at a university that doesn't have any affiliations with the nuclear industry either, because they're in danger of losing their funding if they do anything offensive to the nuclear industry. But say gamma analysis, you can look for cesium-137, which is a significant health threat and a major component of most discharges from nuclear sites. And you can look for americium, which is an alpha emitter and potentially very dangerous if it actually gets inside the human system. And it's closely related to plutonium. So where you find americium, you will also find plutonium. Now, americium, luckily for us, gives off a gamma signal, which is easily detected when you're looking also for cesium. Now, those samples cost a couple of £100 for about a jam jar, 450 grams, maybe a pound of sediment or other material. But if you want to do beta or alpha analysis, then you're starting to move into the thousands, £1,000 for a sample. So it's very, very expensive. This is how governments and the nuclear industry manage to have a stranglehold on analysis, because the rest of us, you know, when I first started doing this kind of stuff, we were having what in the UK were called jumble sales, which is, you know, you collect second-hand unwanted equipment. You undoubtedly have them in the States, but I'm not sure what you call them there.
Yard sales, thrift. What we do is we sell our unwanted or leftover stuff.
Yeah, that's exactly it. So we were doing that and putting on music gigs and just basically standing in the street begging with placards and information desks to raise the money to analyze sediments. And we're pretty much still doing that now, because we can't get money off government to do independent analysis like this. And unfortunately, even with the best will in the world, an independent analytical laboratory still has to run itself. It has costs. And, you can sometimes get favorable terms from them, but they've still got to run themselves and they need the money to come in. So we have to raise, as citizens groups, we have to raise that money. And the gamma analysis is the most I've ever been able to raise enough money to do. Because obviously, to do a decent program of survey, you need a number of survey points and a number of samples. And that's about the best that can be done, other than looking at the official analysis and reviewing and critically analyzing what they're doing and determining whether or not, in the light of one's own experience and aspirations and hopes, whether it's a good job or not. So that, if we look at what's been done at TEPCO, they'll do, they'll maybe go to a sample site and take a fish from it. And then they'll go to another sample and take a fish from it. When you look at it, you think just, okay, as a marine scientist, you look at that and you think, okay, well, what species of fish are they looking at? Are they looking at seabed fish, like flatfish, who live on the bottom and are in contact with those irradiated sediments? Or are they looking at fish like herring or mackerel, which are migratory? So they're only in that particular area for maybe a month, and the rest of the year they're banging around in the rest of the Pacific. And it's the same with, say, the larger species, the top predators like tuna. Okay, so tuna breed and lay their eggs and raise, some of their juveniles are raised off that Japanese coast, but the adults then spend time roaming almost around the entire Pacific for large portions of their life, except perhaps for the breeding season. So they're eating fish which maybe have never been in contact with the Fukushima radioactivity, like down towards the South Pole, the Southern Pacific. They're excreting any radioactivity that they may have picked up in the Fukushima area and reducing their levels that way. So, monitoring and analysis is very complicated work. It's not a matter of just rushing out there and taking a sample here and a sample there. You've got to consider very carefully and program your sampling and your analytical work according to what you think the situation is and what you really want to find out. You don't want to go out there and grab a migratory fish and analyze it and then say, hey, levels aren't very high in this fish, so it's okay to eat all of the fish. And it means that the water that we're in now, it's not very radioactive at all. And the simple fact, as I said earlier, that they don't want to monitor sea-to-land transfer, where all the science talks about 100 times concentration factors of several hundred times, in fact. They don't want to look at that. And in the UK, my information comes from a little study which was done by the nuclear industry, the government-sponsored nuclear industry in the UK. And as soon as they observed that sea-to-land transfer was taking place, they didn't do any more studies. So they had muslin screens on the beach, and they were catching material blowing ashore. And they said, okay, right, okay. They went away. It was only for a short period. They didn't do it in heavy storms when you had big surf and big wave and big sea spray and loads of marine aerosol. They did it in a gentle breeze, and they didn't bother to go inland and find out how far inland the radioactivity was going. And nobody else anywhere else has picked that story up and done anything with it.
Is there anything we haven't covered that you'd like to add at this time?
No, I don't think there's anything else to add to this earthquake story, except to remind listeners that all along the Pacific Rim, it's called the Ring of Fire. Not for nothing is it called the Ring of Fire, because it's always been seismically active. You're always going to have more earthquakes. You're always going to have more volcanicity. And I must say that over the last couple of years, it looks to me, reviewing the earthquake and seismicity data, as if the activity, the seismic activity, particularly in the northern sector of the Pacific Rim, Ring of Fire, is actually on a bit of an upsurge at the moment. So the Tohoku earthquake, which wiped out the Fukushima site, was bad, and it's not beyond the bounds of possibility, Levy, that something approaching that size might be on the way. a warning for the future.
Cheerful thoughts as we face 2026. Tim Dear Jones, it's always an education to have you on the show and learn so specifically how we are being not told the truth about radiation, and especially as it gets released into the Pacific Ocean and other marine bodies, but specifically Fukushima here. And I want to thank you for making yourself available and for being my guest again this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Bless you, Levy. I would like to thank you and your audiences for listening, and my fellow contributors, who I'm sure are as delighted as I am to be able to share this information with you, because I tell you what, it's hard enough to get it out there as it is. So bless you and happy Christmas, and for the future, have a good new year.
Or, as I'm about to send out in a song, Merry Chanukah, Krista Kwanzaa Solstice, Ramamas. UK-based marine biologist Tim Dear Jones. Strange but true, he does not maintain a website and keeps a pretty low profile online. But if you wish to contact him, his email, which we'll also have up on our website, is timdj@talktalk.net. We'll have this week's second featured interview in just a moment, but first, yep, it's the holidays again. And all this holiday spirit means absolutely nothing to the nuclear industry. For them, it's all Christmas all year round, 365 except leap year when it's 366. They just keep pouring millions of dollars into their PR propaganda to sell us the non-existent small modular nuclear reactors and get back billions upon billions of taxpayer dollars for their nuclear Ponzi schemes and boondoggles. All the while, they're making more radioactive waste with not a thought in their pretty little heads as to how to get rid of the stuff, other than by kicking that can down the road onto our children and their children and every generation that follows. That's why sane people like yourself, who are opposed to nukes, need to know the facts in order to take meaningful steps to stop them before it's too late. That's why Nuclear Hot Seat is here. We go after the nuclear story. We know where to look, the questions to ask, what nuclear PR double talk really means, and then we report it back to you. We provide what we have learned is nuclear truth, which is exactly what the industry would rather we not let people hear about, let alone understand, and mainstream reporters don't know or have the opportunity to ask. That's why the best way to celebrate whatever holiday you're celebrating is with a donation to help keep Nuclear Hot Seat going. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com, click on the big red donate button to help us with a donation of any size. And that same red button is now where you can set up a monthly donation of any amount. If it's $5, that's the same as a cup of coffee here in the U.S. So please do what you can to help now. And keep in mind, Nuclear Hot Seat is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which means that your donation is tax deductible. We make it easy for you to do. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com, find that red donate button and click on it and follow the prompts. Or you can send us directly, and no fees are deducted, if you do so via Zelle to info@nuclearhotseat.com. No amount is too small. No amount is too large, so don't wait. Go to nuclearhotseat.com to donate now and know that whatever you can do to help, I am deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now, here's our second featured interview. Back in 2021, I had the privilege of speaking with journalist Helen Young. She is an Emmy Award-winning broadcast journalist who has forged a career as a filmmaker and writer, by blending a passion for investigative reporting with a commitment to illuminating critical issues of the day. We discussed her film, which had just been released, entitled The Nuns, the Priests, and the Bombs, which focused on the Plowshares movement and specifically the actions of Sister Megan Rice, the 83-year-old nun who broke into the quote-unquote Fort Knox of uranium at Oak Ridge, Tennessee. And her full story will be featured on next week's Nuclear Hot Seat. As with all journalists I interview, I asked Helen Young for suggestions on strategies that activists can use to better communicate our perspective with the media and promote our stories. Her comments were so strong and useful, I'm presenting them here as a reminder to give us something to chew on for the coming year and beyond. I spoke with Helen Young on Thursday, November 11, 2021. You are an Emmy Award-winning broadcast journalist. You've worked for both CBS and NBC News for 20 years, as well as many other news outlets. So you have experience and heavy credits. Now, for those of us who oppose nuclear, we have a difficult time getting people to pay attention to our issues, even when the nuclear industry is not running interference on the truth. Admittedly, news organizations are greatly diminished these days in terms of size, staffing, and reach. But there have got to be ways. How do you think we can gain the attention of the tattered remains of the news media to report on the issues that we find so important?
You know, you asked me the $64 million question because this is something that I struggled with with my own film. And I think that, as you know, the media has undergone tremendous change. It's very focused now. When I was working in the television news media, media was not a profit center. It was a public service. And now so many local news operations have gone by the wayside. The whole print industry has had to reassess and it's going digital, as you know. I mean, I think the best way really is to form relationships with local reporters and to really pitch stories and also writing letters to the editor, getting your story or your whatever you're trying to pitch as strongly as possible and as often as possible as you can to some of the people who are working in local news. And I do believe it starts with local news and with local stories. I think that, again, for something like nuclear weapons, that's a little bit more difficult to do, especially the approach that I took, which is to look at the overall issue. But, you know, maybe if I had focused on just a story in a local area. Now with the nuclear energy, you know, I'm learning more about certain things just in listening to your own podcast of certain reactors, for example, in Michigan that you had talked about where the cancer level among children with thyroid cancer is extremely high. Those types of local stories, I think, would gain attention. That would be the approach that I would take. Make it personal as opposed to broad. I don't know if that's an appropriate answer, but I think that this is something that we're all struggling with. Actually, the heartening part of all this, I recently read a book by Professor Lawrence Wittner called Confronting the Bomb. And it's about the nuclear disarmament movement. I think sometimes those of us who are working in this area of trying to raise awareness on the danger of nuclear weapons, for example, feel, wow, we're just like, you know, whistling in the wind. But the truth of the matter is that, as Professor Wittner points out in his book, were it not for the disarmament community and citizen activism, that's really the reason why we haven't seen another nuclear bomb being used. There was tremendous pressure on Kennedy to use bombs, to use nuclear weapons during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And of course, in general, you know, Kennedy had to push back against his military advisors who thought that he was, you know, being a little bit too complacent with the Soviets. But my point is that citizen activism has been extremely important. And I think that's really overlooked. We tend to think that, you know, we're just not having an effect, but we are having an effect. And I think, you know, even like your podcast that goes out into so many countries, you know, people are listening. And like Sister Anne told me in my film, I asked her, like, well, what did you actually accomplish by doing this? You know, you broke into a nuclear facility, you went to prison, you've done 8 of these things. Like, so what gives here? And she said, Helen, you never know. You never know what the effect is going to be. You do it and you just let it go. You can't be looking for, okay, what did I accomplish? She said, you know, Americans were looking for accomplishments or, you know, what did you get out of this? And she said, even if one person is changed by what I did or their thinking has changed, that is an accomplishment. And that's something that I really take to heart. Because, yeah, we're not getting the big CNN, you know, I pre-pitched my film to CNN and I know people there and they didn't air it, but we have to keep up the good fight. It's a matter of persistence and it's a matter of passion, because I'm sure that you wouldn't be doing what you're doing were you not passionate about it. There's no way that you could ever be financially compensated for your work. Let's be honest about it, right?
I'd like to see my monthly expenses be covered.
Yeah. Honestly, you know, for me, it was a labor of love. I know that's a cliche. And for many of the people who worked on the film too, you know, the editor didn't take his full salary, so to speak. So, but I learned a lot doing this, and certainly going forward, everything is streaming now. So we don't really have to depend so much on the big broadcasters. That's changing too. And I feel extremely fortunate that I have a distributor and the film is getting out there.
In your dealings, if you've had any communication with frontline activists who are trying to make you aware of some aspect of the issue, or perhaps are trying to pitch their own take on a story, as a journalist, are there any mistakes that are being made in our outreach? And if so, what might we be able to do to correct that?
You know, when I was working in the news business, we would get assaulted. Truly, we would get a flood of PR releases and people pitching stories to us. Again, I didn't do these types of stories on nuclear weapons when I was working in the media. I can't really see any kind of problem with the way the story is being pitched. No, I mean, the refrain that you get on the nuclear issue is like, you are Pollyanna. Do you really think that nuclear weapons could ever be eliminated in this country? I mean, this is the kind of pushback that I have often gotten. Not that I'm trying to convince anybody, I am trying to tell a story. I mean, I am putting the facts before you. I don't need to convince you. All I need to do is tell you what the truth is. This is part of what I got into when I was working on the film, is I was telling the prosecutor and the Navy, I'm just telling a story. You know, I'm not taking anybody's position, but the facts speak for themselves. So I don't think I really have any point. I'm not really sure if there's anything that you can do that to improve your chances of getting a story accepted, except to tell a great story. That's my only answer to that. A great story is a great story. No matter who you are, if the story tugs at your heart, if there's humanity to it, if there is a compelling character, if there is, you know, separate and apart from the issue, you have to be moved by the character. That's what it's all about, really. And if the character comes with a compelling issue, so much the better.
And I can certainly think of no more compelling issue than the one that we're currently dealing with in all of its many Hydra-headed facets. Anything else that you can think of that might guide us?
You know, you touched on something that I've heard a lot, you know, from the nuclear weapons community, the activists, that they've also talked about this issue. How can we get in our elevator speech? And I've attended a number of meetings where they talked about what can we do, you know, to get people worked up about this. And what they decided to do is to join forces. They're joining forces now with the climate people and seeing the climate connection. There's a climate connection to nuclear weapons. Just today, in fact, there's a new study that shows, you know, what would happen to the climate, for example, if the US and Russia did go to war with each other. So you've got to find the hook into, like, if you're not living near a nuclear reactor, you're like, I don't care, right? Let's be honest, right? But if you can make it important to me, who is not living in Utah or Nevada or wherever, that's how you get people interested. It has to be personally important to you. Putting out a lot of numbers and graphs and things like that, people's eyes glaze over. There is a trick to it in finding the catch of what is going to, as you said, interest someone in an elevator pitch. You know, you may think that nuclear energy is actually clean and the solution, but actually nuclear energy creates just as much carbon as other types of energy. So it has to be made personal and has to be made relevant to that person. That's what I faced with my film. Like, if I did a film about, we're going to spend $1 trillion on nuclear weapons, they are 30 times more powerful than the bombs that dropped in Hiroshima. You know, if we drop bomb in New York, 1.6 million people are going to die. okay, fine. But this nun goes into a nuclear facility and, you know, she's able to use a bolt cutter. Wow, that's pretty interesting. Now I want to know why. Now I get into the issue of nuclear weapon. I mean, that's the kind of conduit. Now, with nuclear energy, it's interesting that you mentioned, because I was just listening to something else the other day about this very issue, this very fact that people are not engaged in the nuclear radiation problem because many of them don't live near these reactors. They don't think that it's affecting them, really. And so I would think that the people who are living in and around that Michigan reactor that Joe Mangano talked about would be having lots of stories in local media about those children. That's a big story. And he said even the information was on the CDC website. As I said before, this is the trickiest question, you know, to try to, because there's so much information that people are flooded with, and especially now, how do you break through that? It is a challenge. I go back to the mantra, which is it has to be personal to get people. It has to impact, and it has to be a story that people like, wow, that gets the attention. That's my own opinion. Because there have been, for example, there was a film called Countdown to Zero about nuclear weapons, where they had all of these great people on it, Colin Powell and the Four Horsemen that I spoke about before, and they were all talking about how bad it is, and oh, if terrorists get it. The film was a bomb. They spent over $1 million on the film. It was a bomb. And they got all this money. I mean, at that time, that $1 million was a lot of money. It was like, oh, nuclear weapons are really scary, you know, and if, yeah, all right, I knew that. But it's so scary that I can't even think about it. It's too scary. And what has happened in the nuclear weapons issue is that there is a nuclear priesthood, the people who know about this, and everybody else is like, you don't know enough about this. Don't worry your pretty little head about it. We'll take care of it. We know. We'll take care of it for you. And this is another problem, because if there's a nuclear confrontation, we all need to be experts because we're all going to be affected by it. That is the truth. But there is this, they call them the nuclear priesthood. But it's changing now. It's changing, Libby. There are more women going into it. There's a big push for diversity now, getting more people of color involved. So there is momentum on that, and that's good. Because we need to look at this from different perspectives. Because when I was researching my film, everything I came across was the military aspect, the strategic aspect of nuclear weapons. There was nothing about the ethical, the moral, the humanitarian part of it. They don't talk about that. So if you can appeal to the heart, not to the brain so much, but to the heart, that's what really moves people, I believe. It's a struggle for all of us who are engaged in this issue to really raise awareness on it.
Thank you for that answer, because I think there are many nuggets of advice that we can follow through on. And at least it's nice to have some commiseration on what the problems are. One of my favorite phrases about the nuclear industry trying to talk us off the deserved panic that we have so often as to their actions. I refer to that as they're there, Missy. Don't worry your pretty little head about it. It's that degree of condescension and lack of attention to the human aspects of what they're doing. They talk about military. They talk about strategy. They talk about security. They don't talk about what's happening on the ground and what the aftermath is. That's what my play is about, and how that restriction was hardwired in immediately after Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So I want to thank you for this injection of journalistic and communications guidance and awareness and perspective on what it is that we're all continuing to do. And again, thank you for joining me here on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you very much for having me, Libby. It's really been a pleasure to speak with you. I appreciate it.
Award-winning broadcast journalist, as well as writer, producer, director, Helen Young. Her film, The Priests, the Nuns, and the Bomb, is available through her website, nunspriestsbombsthefilm.com. We will have a link up to her website and also to the web page for our full interview on the website nuclearhotseat.com under this episode, number 755. As for the play I mentioned that I was writing at the time, Atomic Bill and the Payment Due has already received its world premiere as a staged reading for the Wilmington College Peace Resource Center. It took place last September as part of the Resource Center's 50th anniversary celebration. The play was received with cheers, a standing ovation, and students going on record as saying, quote, "I will never look at nuclear the same ever again," end quote. The show is an Oppenheimer-adjacent true story of media manipulation at the dawn of the atomic age and the New York Times reporter who sold his soul to get the story. Now, I have just learned that the script has been accepted by the Athena Project, a Colorado-based theater, for their January 19 online read and rant program. Mark the time. They listed as 6:30 p.m. Mountain Time because that's where they are, but it's 8:30 p.m. Eastern and 5:30 p.m. Pacific. And again, that's on Monday, January 19. The public is invited to participate, and I'll have details on how you can do it during next week's show. Considering the first two submissions of Atomic Bill and the Payment Due have yielded two acceptances, I have every optimism for the future of this play. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, December 16, 2025. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email each week, go to nuclearhotseat.com. You can't miss the big yellow box. Fill in your first name and an email address, and every week you will get an email with a link to that week's show as soon as it posts and a little information about the content. That way, you never need miss a single episode. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2025, Libby Halevi and Nuclear Hot Seat. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, website, names of any guests whose comments you use, and me. We're going to be going out with the all-holiday song I wrote as my greeting to you for the holiday season. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you, a nuclear accident anywhere is a nuclear accident everywhere. There you have it, your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, don't go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat. Let's sing.
Well, we've gotten to December. 'Tis the season to remember all the friends and fun and family that make the whole year great. So instead of overeating, I am offering this greeting to everyone, no matter how you choose to celebrate. Merry Chana, Krista, Kwanzaa, Solstice, Ramamas. It's the holiday time of year. Krista, Kwanzaa, Solstice, Ramamas. It's the season that brings good cheer. Ooh, be you Jewish, Christian, Buddhist, Hindu, Muslim, if you're coming from love, it's true.
Atheists too.
Merry Chana, Krista, Kwanzaa, Solstice, Ramamas. It's the holiday time of year. Chana, Krista, Kwanzaa, Solstice, Ramamas.